The document of the French Revolution had been influenced by the Declaration of Independence, and Jefferson had counseled Lafayette during its drafting. That Wednesday evening, dinner began at 4 at the Hôtel de Langeac, and conversation continued until 10. For 6 hours he was, Jefferson recalled, a silent witness to a coolness and candor of argument unusual in the conflicts of political opinion, to a logical reasoning and chaste eloquence, disfigured by no gaudy tinsel of rhetoric or declamation, and truly worthy of being placed in parallel with the finest dialogue of antiquity, as handed to us by Xenophon, by Plato, and Cicero. At Jefferson's table, the group had agreed to a structure for the new republic, and decided the fate of the French Constitution. Expectations for revolutionary success ran high. Lafayette, who had sent George Washington the key to the Bastille, was in charge of the security of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, hoping to preserve order as the revolution moved forward. Patsy Jefferson recalled standing at the windows with some friends looking out into the streets of Paris as the king and queen rode by under the protection of her father's colleague and friend. First came the royal coach, and a chamberlain bowed to her. Next, the young women heard cries that resembled the bellowings of thousands of bulls. They were cheers for Lafayette. "Lafayette! Lafayette!" cried the crowds, and the young Frenchman, noticing Patsy watching from the window, bowed to her, a mark of respect she never forgot. All her life she kept a tricolored cockade, the symbol of the early days of the Revolution, as a memento. Jefferson himself was to remain cheerful despite violence and threats of violence. "So far it seemed that your revolution had got along with a steady pace, meeting indeed with occasional difficulties and dangers, but we are not to expect to be translated from despotism to liberty in a featherbed," Jefferson would tell Lafayette. In early September 1789, fighting illness, Jefferson wrote a long letter to James Madison. He composed it in the fevered context of the French Revolution, and by his own account his thinking sprang from particular events in Europe. "I set out on this ground, which I suppose to be self-evident, that the earth belongs in usufruct to the living, that the dead have neither powers nor rights over it." A little later he added, "The earth belongs always to the living generation. They may manage it then and what proceeds from it as they please, during their usufruct. They are masters, too, of their own persons, and consequently may govern them as they please. Every constitution, then, and every law, naturally expires at the end of 19 years, the Jeffersonian definition of a generation." Taken literally, these musings are a prescription for chaos. If there were no authority from precedent, no laws governing property or examples to guide us, then society would be reduced to a state of nature in which the strong could thrive most effectively, taking advantage of the disorder to consolidate power. A key question is whether Jefferson meant posterity to follow his thoughts to the letter, or whether, as he so often did, he was sharing the churnings of an eager mind in a time of change. The latter possibility is most likely, for while he long held to the idea of the exaltation of the present rather than the reflexive preservation of the past, he did not seriously press for the expiration of all laws at generational intervals. In 1789, in particular, he was thinking of the world in which he had lived for the past 5 years, the French nation, in which individual and institutional destinies were determined largely by hereditary station. This principle that the earth belongs to the living and not to the dead is of very extensive application and consequences in every country, and most especially in France. Writing to the Reverend Charles Clay in 1790, within months of returning to the United States, Jefferson was decidedly earthbound. Clay was seeking a congressional seat at the time. Jefferson wrote that, "You are too well informed a politician, too good a judge of men, not to know that the ground of liberty is to be gained by inches, that we must be contented to secure what we can get from time to time, and eternally press forward for what is yet to get." So, which was the real Jefferson? The philosopher advocating the end of binding laws, or the politician who believe that we must be contented to secure what we can get from time to time. The likely truth is that these competing Jeffersons were both real. He thought one way in one era and another way in other eras, and sometimes he thought differently more or less simultaneously, a common human trait, particularly among the curious and the intellectually active. As a political man, he was able to operate on these sundry levels, yet always returned to the arena from the mountaintop to take up governing an imperfect world. In his phrase, eternally pressing forward for what is yet to be had. In France, he was soon back on the issue of rifle manufacturing, a sign he remained tethered to reality. Madison took care with his reply to Jefferson's rhapsodic letter. It often fell to him to absorb raw Jefferson thoughts. One of Madison's many services to the Republic was the mediating role he played in Jefferson's life, often protecting Jefferson from himself. This was such an occasion, and Madison was gently but frankly skeptical. The spirit of philosophical legislation has never reached some parts of the Union, and is by no means the fashion here, either within or without Congress, he wrote Jefferson. Besides this, our hemisphere must be still more enlightened before many of the sublime truths which are seen through the medium of philosophy become visible to the naked eye of the ordinary politician. The medium of philosophy. Madison is saying that Jefferson's enthusiasm for the revolutionary nature of the rights of man in Europe was an enthusiasm divorced from the realities of governing in America. It was a fair point, and the exchange offers an example of Madison's utility to Jefferson as an affectionate, respectful, discreet check on his episodic flights of philosophy. Madison would always be there for Jefferson, reminding him, deftly, of his own core convictions about the limits of politics, the imperfections of government, and the realities of human nature. On the last Sunday in September 1789, Thomas Jefferson left Paris with his daughters and Sally and James Hemings to return to America. At Le Havre and Cowes, he showed others how to measure the width of a river, and tutored Polly in Spanish. He also set out roving through the neighborhood of this place to try to get a pair of shepherd's dogs, he wrote. We walked 10 miles, clambering the cliffs in quest of the shepherds. During the most furious tempest of wind and rain I was ever in. No dogs, but on the walk he encountered a disturbing scene. On our return, he wrote, we came on the body of a man who had at that moment shot himself. His pistol had dropped at his feet, and himself fallen backward without ever moving. The shot had completely separated his whole face from the forehead to the chin, and so torn it to atoms that it could not be known. The center of the head was entirely laid bare. The day after the storm and the discovery of the suicide, Jefferson found a dog to buy, purchasing a Chien Berger, big with pup. He thought sheepdogs the most careful, intelligent dogs in the world. He soon set sail. Aboard the ship, Sally Hemings was among those in service to Jefferson and his family, as she would remain until the day he died, 37 summers later. Part 6. The First Secretary of State, 1789 to 1792. We have been fellow laborers and fellow sufferers, and heaven has rewarded us with a happy issue from our struggles. It rests now with ourselves alone to enjoy in peace and concord the blessings of self-government, so long denied to mankind, to show by example the sufficiency of human reason for the care of human affairs, and that the will of the majority, the natural law of every society, is the only sure guardian of the rights of man. Thomas Jefferson, in reply to the address of the people of Albemarle County, Virginia, on the eve of his becoming Secretary of State. Chapter 23. A New Post in New York. In general, I think it necessary to give as well as take in a government like ours. Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was at Eppington, the Epps estate on the Appomattox River in Chesterfield County, southwest of Richmond, when the official request arrived. With his daughters Polly and Patsy, and with Sally and James Hemmings, he had crossed aboard the Clermont in fine autumn weather, reaching Norfolk, Virginia on Monday, November 23, 1789, at 1:45 in the afternoon. Slowly making their way to Monticello, they had stopped at the Eppes's, not least to give Polly the chance to reunite with the aunt and uncle she loved. Friday, December 11, 1789, brought an offer from the president, one that had been mentioned in the newspapers in circulation when Jefferson arrived in Virginia from Paris. Would Jefferson become Secretary of State? Jefferson sent Washington an inconclusive reply. Believing the State Department was to be responsible for many domestic as well as all foreign affairs, Jefferson was daunted, and said so, admitting that he feared the criticisms and censures of a public just, indeed, in their intentions, but sometimes misinformed and misled, and always too respectable to be neglected. He was trapped in a familiar paradox. Devoted to the stage and anxious for applause, Jefferson feared failure and disapproval. In times of trial and hours of public attack, he could eloquently articulate his longing for retirement from politics. Yet what repelled him about public life was of a piece with what drew him to it. He longed to be great, and felt greatly. His will to serve and sacrifice was as ferocious as the anguish he experienced when those whom he was serving and for whom he was sacrificing found him wanting. One might think that a man who so hated criticisms and censures would indeed withdraw from the scene of affairs and live out his days relatively safe from conversational and political condemnation. Such a withdrawal, however, would have been unnatural for Jefferson, a denial of his essential character, a character at once human and heroic. He was both an unflinching political warrior and an easily wounded soul. He always would be. Washington left the tactical work of bringing Jefferson aboard to James Madison, who came to Monticello at the end of 1789 to talk things over and correct Jefferson's mistaken view of the duties of the office. The Secretary of State was not to be in charge of all domestic affairs. He was, rather, to serve as the President's chief foreign policy adviser. All whom I have heard speak on the subject are remarkably solicitous for Jefferson's acceptance, Madison wrote to Washington, and I flatter myself that they will not, in the final event, be disappointed. The prospect of broad approval resonated with Jefferson and reassured Washington that Jefferson was worth the back and forth over the post. After conferring with Madison in New York in mid-January, Washington wrote Jefferson making a strong case for the cabinet over returning to France to resume his work there. Washington told Jefferson that, in order that you may be the better prepared to make your ultimate decision on good grounds, I think it necessary to add that your late appointment has given very extensive and very great satisfaction to the public. Washington wanted an answer. Jefferson could come to New York or return to France, but he needed to decide. What to do? He loved Paris, and a diplomatic appointment gave him an unusual degree of autonomy and insulation from constant criticism. Yet he had devoted his life to the success of the American Revolution, and now had to determine where, in the cabinet or in France, he could render the most valuable service to that larger cause. He accepted Washington's offer. Explaining his thinking to a friend, Jefferson spoke in practical political terms. Washington's communications left me at liberty to accept it or return to France, but I saw plainly he preferred the former, and learnt from several quarters, chiefly from Madison, it would be more agreeable. Consequently, to have gone back would have exposed me to the danger of giving disgust, and I value no office enough for that. Jefferson's years as Secretary of State were both tumultuous and thrilling. Out of them came the convictions and tactical sense that Jefferson took to the vice presidency and to the presidency itself. The drama of the country's first cabinet shaped Thomas Jefferson and the nation far beyond the life of Washington's administration. On the Jeffersons' return to Virginia, Patsy, now 17, soon decided to marry her third cousin, Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr., the 21-year-old son of Jefferson's childhood housemate. They had met when Patsy was a child, during two Jefferson family visits to Tuckahoe, once in 1781 during the British invasion, and again in 1783. Ambitious, well-educated, and black-haired, young Randolph had moved quickly once the family had landed at Norfolk in 1789. Though his talents, dispositions, connections, and fortune were such as would have made him my own first choice, I scrupulously suppressed my wishes that my daughter might indulge her own sentiments freely, Jefferson wrote a friend in France. He delayed his departure to arrange Patsy's marriage settlement with the Randolphs. He wanted to make sure everything was done correctly. The wedding took place in February 1790. That Patsy married so soon upon arrival in the United States to a man she did not know well is something of a curiosity. Historians have speculated that she was perhaps reacting to her father's liaison with Sally Hemings. The daughter may have felt displaced in her father's affections in some way. It is also possible that things were just as they appeared to be. Patsy was of marriageable age, young Randolph was a fitting suitor, and he appeared to be a man not unlike her beloved father. Randolph was interested in farming, science, law, and politics. Patsy did not hesitate when offered the opportunity to begin the next natural chapter with a man whom her father liked and who shared her father's interests. Sally Hemings was to remain at Monticello when Jefferson moved to New York. Her main work through the years was the care and tending of Jefferson's private rooms and his wardrobe. He trusted her with the things he valued most. The precise location of her living quarters at this time is unknown, but she may have lived in one of the new log servants' houses constructed in the mid-1790s along Mulberry Row, the nearby principal plantation street which Monticello historians note was lined with about 20 dwellings, workshops, and sheds where dozens of slaves and free white workers lived and worked. During and after Jefferson's presidential years, Sally Hemings is thought to have had quarters in the South Terrace Wing, constructed between 1802 and 1809. Jefferson's journey north to New York was slow and at times snowy, yet it seemed a kind of political springtime. From London, Richard Price, an elderly radical English philosopher who had long supported the American Revolution, articulated the hopes of many. The Congress under the new Constitution is, I suppose, now met in America, and I am longing to hear that they go on prosperously. Price had written to Jefferson at the time of George Washington's inauguration. Being now advanced into the evening of life, it is with particular gratitude I look back and reflect that I have been spared to see the human species improved, religious intolerance almost extinguished, the eyes of the lower ranks of men opened to see their rights, and nations panting for liberty that seemed to have lost the idea of it. In New York, Jefferson could not find quarters on what he called the Broadway, instead leasing a house at 57 Maiden Lane in Lower Manhattan. The house, he told Patsy, was an indifferent one. Old friends, such as the Adamses, were happy to see him. "Mr. Jefferson is here and adds much to the social circle," Abigail Adams wrote in April 1790. The Vice President and Mrs. Adams had taken a house called Richmond Hill in the then relatively remote neighborhood that became Greenwich Village. The world was never quiet. At home and abroad, and the two spheres were connected, with foreign wars and confrontations shaping domestic life and politics, the 1790s were to prove complex. In the late summer of 1791, Leopold II, the Holy Roman Emperor and brother of Marie Antoinette, in company with Frederick William II of Prussia, issued the Declaration of Pillnitz in defense of the French royal family. In turn, in the spring of 1792, the French revolutionaries declared war on Austria, thus opening a 13-year series of wars between revolutionary and later Napoleonic France and monarchical Europe. The violence of the French Revolution, including the executions of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette in 1793, and the institution of the Terror in 1794, drew Britain and Spain into war with France. The conflicts of the Old World created complications for the New. Before the decade was out, the United States would face possible wars against Britain because of Britain's war with France, and with France because of France's war with Britain. Through these trials and their domestic manifestations, including a hard-line limitation of civil liberties amid fears of war with France in the last years of the 1790s, Jefferson was variously Secretary of State, a leader of the opposition to the policies of George Washington, and then of John Adams, and Vice President of the United States. Jefferson's conduct in the maelstroms of the decade was driven in large measure by his twin devotions to liberty and to power. He could be overly generous to France, but much of his sympathy for the French Revolution was connected to his antipathy for and fear of the royalism of the British. For all the crises, Jefferson would end the decade of the 1790s as he began it, as a protector of the American experiment and defender of American interests. On Sunday, March 21, 1790, the first Secretary of State paid his first official call on the first President of the United States. It marked the beginning of 4 years of what Jefferson described as a daily, confidential, and cordial relationship between the two men. There was so much to cover that the initial conversation could not be confined to a single meeting. The two men met again on Monday, after Washington sat for a portrait by the painter John Trumbull, and on Tuesday. Washington and Jefferson had known each other for nearly a quarter of a century, since the days when both were burgesses in Williamsburg, moving around the old colonial capital between the Assembly Room and the Raleigh Tavern. Washington had reason to think well of the man sitting before him in the March light. Many had testified to Jefferson's strengths. "Nothing can excel Mr. Jefferson's abilities, virtues, pleasing temper, and everything in him that constitutes the great statesman, zealous citizen, and amiable friend," Lafayette had told Washington in 1788. After spending time with Jefferson in France, the American merchant Nathaniel Cutting wrote, "I have found Mr. Jefferson a man of infinite information and sound judgment. Becoming gravity and engaging affability mark his deportment. His general abilities are such as would do honor to any age or country." From Paris, a few years before, John Adams had told Secretary of War Henry Knox, "You can scarcely have heard a character too high of my friend and colleague Mr. Jefferson, either in point of power or virtues." To Jefferson, Washington had been a grand, often distant figure, whose grace and aloofness made him a living figure of myth. He was incapable of fear, meeting personal dangers with the calmest unconcern, Jefferson wrote long afterward. Perhaps the strongest feature in his character was prudence, never acting until every circumstance, every consideration was maturely weighed, refraining if he saw doubt, but when once decided, going through with his purpose whatever obstacles opposed. Jefferson was less impressed with Washington's intellectual gifts. His mind was great and powerful, without being of the very first order. His penetration strong, though not so acute as that of a Newton, Bacon, or Locke, and as far as he saw, no judgment was ever sounder. It was slow in operation, being little aided by invention or imagination, but sure in conclusion. There were hidden depths. His temper was naturally irritable and high-toned, but reflection and resolution had obtained a firm and habitual ascendancy over it, Jefferson continued. If ever, however, it broke its bonds, he was most tremendous in his wrath. Washington was a man, in other words, around whom one was careful. Shortly after arriving in New York, Jefferson was struck by one of his episodic headaches, suggesting that he was perhaps uneasy about the duties and the scrutiny that awaited him. For 5 years he had been largely removed from the daily, even hourly, cut and thrust of American politics. As a diplomat in a foreign land, he had been more of an observer than an actor. As the senior cabinet officer in the new government, he was exposed to the voracious attention of the New York political class. It took time for him to acclimate himself, and his dependence on Madison was explicit and rather touching. Seeking Madison's opinion on a question of form, how the state should communicate with the federal House and Senate, Jefferson acknowledged his debt. "Be so good as to say what you think," Jefferson wrote. I must be troublesome to you till I know better the ground on which I am placed." He was clear on one thing. He held an executive office of responsibility and of authority. "The transaction of business with foreign nations is executive altogether," he wrote in April 1790. "It belongs then to the head of that department, except as to such portions of it as are specially submitted to the Senate. Exceptions are to be construed strictly." Jefferson marked his 47th birthday in his first weeks in New York. One of the most celebrated Americans in the world, he was an unfamiliar figure to many of those who had come to the national stage during the 5 years he spent in Paris. William McClay, a senator from Pennsylvania, who was hostile to the administration, found Jefferson's demeanor surprising and rather disappointing. "He had a rambling, vacant look, and nothing of that firm, collected deportment which I expected would dignify the presence of a secretary or minister," said McClay. "I looked for gravity, but a laxity of manner seemed shed about him. He spoke almost without ceasing, but even his discourse partook of his personal demeanor. It was loose and rambling, and yet he scattered information wherever he went, and some even brilliant sentiments sparkled from him." Others saw him differently through the years. To the newspaper publisher Samuel Harrison Smith, he was lofty and erect, his motions flexible and easy, neither remarkable for nor deficient in grace, and such were his strength and agility. His information was equally polite and profound, and his conversational powers capable of discussing moral questions of deepest seriousness, or the lighter themes of humor and fancy, wrote an English traveler named John Bernard. "Nothing could be more simpler than his reasonings, nothing more picturesque and pointed than his descriptions. On all abstract subjects he was plainness, a veritable Quaker, but when conveying his views of human nature through that most attractive medium, anecdote, he displayed the grace and brilliance of a courtier." Jefferson believed in the politics of the personal relationship. "When the hour of dinner is approaching, sometimes it rains, sometimes it is too hot for a long walk. Sometimes your business would make you wish to remain longer at your office or return there after dinner and make it more eligible to take any sort of a dinner in town," Jefferson wrote Henry Knox in July 1791. "Any day and every day that this would be the case, you would make me supremely happy by messing with me, without ceremony or other question than whether I dine at home. The hour is from 3:15 to 3:15, and taking your chance as to fare, you will be sure to meet a sincere welcome." He saw himself as a political creature. Replying to a correspondent who questioned his anti-British tone in the Notes on the State of Virginia, Jefferson noted that those words dated from the war, but that Britain had done little to build constructive relations with her former colonies. "Perhaps their conduct and dispositions towards us since the war have not been as well calculated as they might have been to excite more favorable dispositions on our part," Jefferson said in November 1790. "Still, as a political man, they shall never find any passion in me either for or against them. Whenever their avarice of commerce will let them meet us fairly halfway, I should meet them with satisfaction because it would be for our benefit. But I mistake their character if they do this under present circumstances." Though he tried to make himself pleasant, Jefferson found New York politically uncomfortable. He suffered, he recalled, from wonder and mortification at the prevailing Federalist climate in governing circles. On evenings out, he believed himself, for the most part, the only advocate on the Republican side of the question. The quasi-regal air around the president, the levees and the bows, the enormous carriage with numerous horses, bothered Jefferson, who believed substance could follow style. A tilt toward the monarchical in form might, he feared, precede a move toward the autocratic in fact. Further evidence for such conclusions could be found in the Gazette of the United States, published in New York by John Fenno. In a series of essays entitled Discourses on Davila, John Adams, writing pseudonymously, made the case that pure democracy was unnatural. "One question only shall be respectfully insinuated, whether equal laws, the result only of a balanced government, can ever be obtained and preferred without some signs or other of distinction and degree. Adams continued, "We are told that our friends, the National Assembly of France, have abolished all distinctions. But be not deceived, my dear countrymen. Impossibilities cannot be performed. Have they leveled all fortunes and equally divided all property? Have they made all men and women equally wise, elegant, and beautiful?" Worried about the implications of Adams's argument, that distinctions, possibly hereditary, were intrinsic and might prevail in the New World as well as the Old, Jefferson arranged for Fenno to publish a translation of a National Assembly address to the people. "The nation, the law, the king. The nation is yourselves, the law is still yourselves, it is your will. The king is the guardian of the law." By urging Fenno to print translated excerpts from the Gazette de Leyde, a reliably Republican Dutch paper published in French, Jefferson was putting his own views in the pages that promulgated the Federalist line. By early August 1790, Fenno became entirely a creature of the Federalist faction, but for a brief time, Jefferson was able to avail himself of the paper. He was not fighting solely tactical battles. He was also thinking grandly. "I have but one system of ethics for men and for nations," he wrote a French friend in April 1790, "to be grateful, to be faithful to all engagements and under all circumstances, to be open and generous, promotes in the long run even the interests of both, and I am sure it promotes their happiness." There was a late snow in New York in the last week of April 1790. Not long afterward, President Washington became so ill that he was thought to be dying. By early June, however, the president was well enough to take Jefferson along on a fishing trip off Sandy Hook. Jefferson, ever practical and optimistic, hoped any seasickness would carry off the remains of my headache. After he had returned from the fishing excursion, Jefferson ran into Alexander Hamilton near Washington's house one evening. Born in 1755 on the British West Indian island of Nevis, Hamilton spent much of his early life on St. Croix. An illegitimate child, he was the son of a French Huguenot mother and a Scottish laird. His mother died when he was 13. He became a self-taught man, driven by ambition to overcome the obscurity of his origins. He clerked for a time, and then, with the financial support of locals who sensed his potential, went to New York for schooling, ultimately enrolling at King's College, present-day Columbia University. Quick with his pen, he was a prolific essayist. He became a top aide to General Washington during the Revolution. He married into a powerful New York family, the Schuylers, and served as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. His father-in-law, Senator Philip Schuyler, was said to be amazingly fond of the old leaven of monarchism. Hamilton favored a strong national government, and to a degree sought to emulate the basic British financial and commercial systems. His was a rational and coherent vision of public life, and he believed his vision the best course for the United States. Skeptical about the durability of republican institutions based on broad suffrage and regular elections, as any student of history and human nature would be, there was nothing like America in the world, Hamilton was more open than Jefferson was to the adaptation of old-world features to American government. And Hamilton was willing to entertain the possibilities of a hereditary, or at least lifelong, presidency or Senate. In a speech to the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton has spoken of a possible American monarch who would be capable of resisting the popular current. More immediately, Hamilton advocated a strong relationship with Britain, which, given the realities of the day, meant the United States would be a subordinate power to London. Many, though not all, of Hamilton's views set him apart from Jefferson, and some of those views were so strongly expressed that Jefferson began to define himself in opposition to the Treasury Secretary. Jefferson, for example, had long believed in and fought for a respected and effective national government. After his experience of the Ancien Régime in France, though, and given his anxiety about British designs on America, Jefferson found the discovery of a quasi-monarchical culture growing up around President Washington unsettling. Jefferson believed in a powerful republican government. As the Washington administration unfolded, Jefferson came to see Hamilton as the embodiment of the deepest of Republican fears, as a man who might be willing to sacrifice the American undertaking in liberty to the expediency of arbitrary authority. And Hamilton came to see Jefferson as a man who might be willing to throw everything the Americans had built to the revolutionary winds blowing from France. It was an extreme overheated view of Hamilton, as of Jefferson, but it was a time of extreme and overheated views. Such was the political reality of the day, and Hamilton and Jefferson were politicians. In later years, when passions had cooled, Jefferson acquired a bust of Hamilton and placed it opposite one of himself in the entrance hall at Monticello. According to the biographer Henry Randall, the eye settled with a deeper interest on busts of Jefferson and Hamilton by Cherokee, placed on massive pedestals on each side of the main entrance. "Opposed in death as in life," as the surviving original sometimes remarked with a pensive smile, as he observed the notice they attracted. On this particular night in New York City in 1790, Jefferson found the Treasury Secretary somber, haggard, and dejected beyond description, Jefferson wrote. Even his dress was uncouth and neglected. Hamilton had reason to be out of sorts. In his Report on the Public Credit in early 1790, another followed at the end of the year, Hamilton had argued for a national financial system in which the central government would fund the national debt, assume responsibility for all state debts, and establish a national bank. Money for the federal government would be raised by tariffs on imports and excise taxes on distilled spirits. Funding the debt, which basically meant the federal government would pay holders of federal securities their nominal or face value, which was higher than their original value, was controversial, for speculators had been purchasing those securities from the securities' initial holders for less than Hamilton was proposing to pay the current holders. A political and emotional complication was that many of the initial holders were revolutionary veterans, unaware that the paper they owned was about to be worth more. They had often been paid for their services in Continental paper. Shrewder speculators, Madison told Jefferson, were exploring the interior and distant parts of the Union in order to take advantage of the ignorance of the holders. Despite these concerns, Hamilton carried the day on the federal purchase of the securities, successfully beginning to put the federal government in the center of the nation's financial system. The second element of Hamilton's plan, the assumption of all the state debts by the federal government, would further secure the federal establishment's standing. The consolidation of debts at the federal level would create the need for federal taxes to pay down the debts, and the power to tax was, as ever, the most fundamental and far-reaching of all the powers of government, with the possible exception of the war-making power, which is actually also partly about taxes, since wars are so costly. The assumption proposal, however, instantly divided the nation. Four states, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, and Maryland, had already been fiscally responsible and paid off much of their revolutionary debts. Others, chiefly Massachusetts, South Carolina, and Connecticut, had not, and were therefore quite happy to send their bills to Hamilton in New York. The more fiscally responsible states believed that they would inevitably end up paying federal taxes to bail out their lagging neighbors. On Monday, April 12, 1790, about 3 weeks after Jefferson's arrival in New York, the Madison-led forces in the House voted down federal assumption of state debts by 3 votes. It was a devastating defeat for the Treasury Secretary. The unkempt Hamilton that Jefferson met near the President's house needed allies. He asked for a word with his cabinet colleague, and the two men spoke in the street near Washington's door. Would Jefferson help Hamilton with the assumption issue? Without a solution, Hamilton believed the continuance of the Union was at risk. Jefferson knew matters were dire. The Congress seemed paralyzed. It was a real fact, he said, that the Eastern and Southern members had got into the most extreme ill humor with one another, leading to an atmosphere marked by the most alarming heat and the bitterest animosities. Jefferson appreciated the need for unified action. Unlike many of his fellow Virginians, the Secretary of State was not reflexively opposed to assumption. Those who were, though, wanted something in return for seeming to invest the northern part of the nation with even more financial power. The location of the national capital offered some hope for a deal. New York was already the financial center of the nation, and the middle and southern states were eager to see the political seat of government elsewhere. Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Georgetown on the Potomac were candidates. There was also talk of Trenton, New Jersey, or a site along the Susquehanna River. The Potomac stands a bad chance, and yet it is not impossible that in the vicissitudes of the business, it may turn up in some form or other, Madison wrote Monroe in June 1790. As Jefferson listened to Hamilton, as he read correspondence from the South, and as he thought through the sundry issues at hand, he realized that perhaps, just perhaps, there was room for a compromise. The beginning of wisdom, Jefferson thought, might lie in a meeting of the principals out of the public eye. So he convened a dinner. Jefferson believed things could be worked out, he said, for men of sound heads and honest views needed nothing more than explanation and mutual understanding to enable them to unite in some measures which might enable us to get along. No deal meant disaster. It was clear, Jefferson wrote, that if everyone retains inflexibly his present opinion, there will be no bill passed at all for funding the public debts, and without funding, there is an end of the government. At dinner, Madison agreed to ease his opposition to assumption and leave it to its fate in the Congress. A victory for Hamilton. In Jefferson's account, either Madison or Hamilton then said that, as the pill would be a bitter one to the southern states, something should be done to soothe them. The capital ought to be sited along the Potomac. The final result, Jefferson believed, was the least bad of all the turns the thing can take. It was true that he hated the financial speculation that would result from the Hamiltonian vision of commerce. It is much to be wished that every discouragement should be thrown in the way of men who undertake to trade without capital, Jefferson said. The consumers pay for it in the end, and the debts contracted and bankruptcies occasioned by such commercial adventurers bring burden and disgrace on our country. Yet Jefferson also believed in compromise. He advised his daughter Patsy to approach all people and all things with forbearance. Every human being, my dear, must thus be viewed according to what it is good for none of us, no, not one, is perfect. And were we to love none who had imperfections, this world would be a desert for our love, Jefferson wrote in July 1790. All we can do is to make the best of our friends, love and cherish what is good in them, and keep out of the way of what is bad. But no more think of rejecting them for it than of throwing away a piece of music for a flat passage or two. It was sound counsel for life at Monticello and at New York. In December 1790, a Virginian wrote Jefferson about the State General Assembly's official protest over the debt assumption. One party charges the Congress with an unconstitutional act, and both parties charge it with an act of injustice. So be it. Jefferson had struck the deal he could strike, and for the moment, America was the stronger for it. Chapter 24. Mr. Jefferson is greatly too democratic. I own it is my own opinion that the present government is not that which will answer the ends of society, and that it will probably be found expedient to go into the British form. Alexander Hamilton, according to an account of Jefferson's. Jefferson had become Secretary of State on Monday, March 22, 1790. His first opinion on the possibility of an American war was written for President Washington 112 days later, hardly an epoch of peace. Little wonder his headache plagued him so much in these months. A world war seemed at hand. In July 1789, Spain, long the dominant power in the Pacific Northwest, had seized two English ships at Nootka Sound, a distant inlet on the western coast of Vancouver Island. With its lucrative fur trade and importance to any significant system of commerce with Asia, the region was of interest to Spain as well as to Russia and Great Britain. In 1778, Captain James Cook, the English explorer, had landed at Nootka and renamed it King George's Sound. The Spanish, who dated their claims to the area to a decree of Pope Alexander VI in the 15th century, were determined to fend off the encroachments of other nations. A Spanish explorer, Esteban José Martínez, arrived in the spring of 1789 and took control of the British vessels Princess Royal and Argonaut and of their captains and crews. News of the Spanish attack stunned Britain, inciting talk of war with Spain. Writing from London after dining with members of Parliament late one night in early May 1790, the South Carolina lawyer and politician John Rutledge told Jefferson that he had never been amongst such insolent bullies as these British lawmakers. They were all for war, talked much of Old England and the British Lion, laughed at the idea of drubbing the Dons, and began to calculate the millions of dollars Spain would be obliged to pay for having insulted the first power on earth. Merriment in England meant anxiety in America. Jefferson fretted about a sprawling war. Britain would be likely to dispatch its troops in Canada to seize Louisiana and the Floridas, both Spanish territories. France, an ally of Spain's, would be pulled into the fight. There would be combat on oceans the world over. And the United States, with just over a year's experience under its new constitution, would be in the middle of it all. War, Jefferson said, was very possible. His worst fear, perhaps, was the prospect of encirclement by the British. Vice President Adams agreed with Jefferson, and Secretary of War Knox believed English control of the Floridas and the Mississippi would lead to great and permanent evils. As a nation in the middle of an emerging conflict, America had to decide whether to allow foreign troops to march through U.S. territory. Jefferson favored what he called a middle course, which meant delaying any answer in the event of a request from Britain. If an answer had to be given, however, he supported allowing the British troops passage, since a refusal was likely to start a U.S.-British war. While willing to fight, Jefferson also said, "War is full of chances," suggesting it was wisest to keep as many options open as possible. It was the practical position. The Nootka Sound episode coincided with a planned American campaign against the Shawnee and Miami Indians to be led by Arthur St. Clair, the governor of the Northwest Territory. An important issue arose. Should the Americans tell the British about the operation, at the risk of having the British pass along advance word to the Indians, their allies, in harassing Americans along the frontier? Jefferson told Washington that the Americans should keep the Indian mission a secret. What neither the President nor the Secretary of State knew was that Alexander Hamilton had already informed England through a British envoy named George Beckwith, who had played a role in turning Benedict Arnold away from the American cause. Hamilton's relationship with Beckwith sheds light on the Treasury Secretary's basic sympathies and operating style. In 1789, Hamilton had privately asked Beckwith to tell the British authorities that Washington's government was open for business with London. "I have always preferred a connection with you to that of any other country," Hamilton said to Beckwith, continuing, "We think in English and have a similarity of prejudices and of predilections." It was a clear effort to become part of Britain's sphere rather than France's, the opposite of the course Jefferson favored. In the event of war between France and Britain, America's naval exertions, Hamilton told Beckwith, may in your scale be greatly important and decisive. Such views, Hamilton said, may be depended upon as the sentiments of the most enlightened men in this country. But they were not Jefferson's sentiments, which the Hamiltonians knew. "Mr. Jefferson is greatly too democratic for us at present," William Samuel Johnson, a senator from Connecticut, told Beckwith. The pro-British interest in America embarked on a campaign to paint Jefferson as a dreamer, not a man of affairs. "Mr. Jefferson is a man of some acquirements, but his opinions upon government are the result of fine-spun theoretic systems drawn from the ingenious writings of Locke, Sidney, and others of their caste, which can never be realized," Senator William Patterson of New Jersey told George Beckwith. In the end, Spain backed down. The expedition against the Indians failed for reasons unrelated to Hamilton's disclosure. For Jefferson and his contemporaries, the Nootka episode's possible enormousness, its suddenness, and its coming at such an early hour in the life of the government helped create a habit of mind that persisted through the years. The world was rife with danger. Any particular event could produce universal calamity, and the old world, especially Britain, France, and Spain, remained threats to American serenity and security. The national capital moved from New York to Philadelphia in 1790, its temporary home, until the District of Columbia could be made ready at the beginning of the next decade. En route to Philadelphia in early November, Jefferson and Madison stopped at Mount Vernon to spend the night with Washington. Jefferson was impressed by the president's skills as a planter and accepted the gift of some wheat to send to Patsy's husband, Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr., to plant at Monticello. Jefferson offered specific directions for his son-in-law. "The richest ground in the garden will be best," he said, "and the seed should be planted in distinct holes at proper distances." Leasing a 4-story brick house from Thomas Leiper at 274 High Street in Philadelphia, Jefferson ordered shipments of wine for himself and for Washington, and then immersed himself in the passion and action of the season. On three separate but related issues, Jefferson fought to create an America that could, so far as possible, become respected, prosperous, and peaceable, without being overly dependent on any one ally. From decisions about commercial and diplomatic relations with Britain and France, to the struggle over the British impressment of an American seaman named Hugh Purdy, to the projection of force against pirates in the Mediterranean, Jefferson sought free trade, mutual regard, and justice. Yet on the establishment of a national bank and the imposition of an excise tax on what Jefferson called ardent spirits, Hamilton's financial program took precedence. The tax passed without much drama. With the funding of the debt and assumption now settled, the government needed revenue to operate under its new obligations. The proposal for a national bank, however, precipitated a significant debate about the role of the federal government and the relative influence of Hamilton and Jefferson in Washington's orbit. Hamilton wanted the bank to be funded by federal deposits, but run, in part, for the benefit of private investors. Jefferson and Madison objected. They feared that the Hamiltonian program would enable financial speculators to benefit from the commercial transactions made possible by government funds. Washington privately asked Jefferson for his view on the bank bill's constitutionality. Jefferson replied with an argument for strict construction, that any power not specifically mentioned in the Constitution was reserved for the states, not the federal government. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer susceptible of any definition, Jefferson wrote in February 1791. An improviser and a nationalist, Jefferson would not prove dogmatic on such issues. Only when viewed in the light of the moment, as the only means available to register a protest against the triumph of Hamilton's vision, and when considered with an appreciation for Jefferson's interpretation of that vision, that it tended to create a climate more congenial to absolutism than to republican democracy, does the opinion fit into the whole of Jeffersonian thinking. Even in 1791, Jefferson was not doctrinaire about his opinion, closing his letter to Washington with pragmatic counsel. "If the pro and con hang so even as to balance the president's judgment, a just respect for the wisdom of the legislature would naturally decide the balance in favor of their opinion." Hamilton replied brilliantly, arguing that an adherence to the letter of the Constitution's powers would at once arrest the motions of government. Hamilton won, but only barely. Washington had Madison draft a veto message, which was never issued, and took the maximum time allowed by the Constitution to sign the bill. Yet, in a victory for Hamilton, the president did sign it. "Congress may go home," wrote William McClay. "Mr. Hamilton is all-powerful and fails in nothing he attempts." It was springtime in Philadelphia. Writing Polly, Jefferson recorded the burst of colors. "April 5th, apricots in blossom, cherry leafing. 9. Peach in blossom, apple leafing. April 11th, cherry in blossom. Still, Hamilton was not far from Jefferson's mind. Jefferson wrote to James Monroe, "We are ruined, sir, if we do not overrule the principles that the more we owe, the more prosperous we shall be, that a public debt furnishes the means of enterprise, etc., etc." That same day he wrote Patsy about bonnets and a new style of hat in Philadelphia. "Mrs. Trist has observed that there is a kind of veil lately introduced here, and much approved. It fastens over the brim of the hat, and then draws round the neck as close or open as you please." Just over a week later, Jefferson set off a new storm with a brief letter. The note he wrote was not long, only four sentences, two of which were formulaic, but few communications of Jefferson's life produced equal effects. Madison had passed on to Jefferson a borrowed copy of the first part of Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, just published in England. The pamphlet's owner, John Beckley, clerk of the House of Representatives, asked Jefferson to send it on to Jonathan B. Smith, a Philadelphia merchant, whose brother, Samuel Harrison Smith, planned to publish it in America. In his accompanying note of April 26, 1791, Jefferson mused, briefly, in the third person. Jefferson said that he was extremely pleased to find Paine's work will be reprinted here, and that something is at length to be publicly said against the political heresies which have sprung up among us. He has no doubt our citizens will rally a second time round the standard of common sense, by which, of course, he meant Paine's Common Sense of 1776. In a matter of days, Jefferson opened a copy of the newly republished text to find that his words in the covering note had been reprinted as well. The implication was clear. Jefferson not only appeared to be Paine's sponsor, but also believed there were heresies in circulation among us. So it was that the Secretary of State appeared to be declaring war on the Vice President of the United States and the Secretary of the Treasury. That I had, in my view, the discourses on Davila, which had filled Fanno's papers for a 12-month without contradiction, is certain, Jefferson told the President in the wake of the publication. But nothing was ever further from my thoughts than to become myself the contradictor before the public. He had written it, he told Madison, to take off a little of the dryness of the note. Hamilton, Jefferson believed, was seizing on the Rights of Man note to Jonathan Smith as evidence of Jefferson's opposition to the government. Jefferson disagreed strongly, telling Madison that his remarks had been meant for the enemies of the government, to wit, those who want to change it into a monarchy. He added that he believed Hamilton was attacking him with vigor. "I have reason to think Hamilton has been unreserved in uttering these sentiments." And there was little Jefferson hated more than the thought that people were disparaging him in the shadows. There is much truth in the tendency to encapsulate the competing traditions of the early American Republic as a contest between Jefferson and Hamilton. For partisans of each man, it was then, and has been ever since, convenient to caricature the other, with Hamilton as the scheming proto-Brit bent on monarchy, and Jefferson as the naive proto-Frenchman intoxicated by visions of excessive democracy. Inevitably, though, such shorthand is incomplete. In the first hours of the decade, and sporadically throughout, Jefferson sometimes found himself in agreement with Hamilton, and with Washington and Adams as well. For Jefferson was a working politician and diplomat who believed in an effective central government. His experience in the Virginia governorship and during the Confederation years had convinced him of that, and often asserted the need to project power. There was, however, a foundational point on which Jefferson never compromised, a conviction that drove much of his political life from 1790 until his death. He feared monarchy or dictatorship, which is different from fearing a strong national government, though Jefferson is often thought to have believed them the same thing. One of the terms he used to describe his opponents, monocrats, is telling, for the word means government by the one. Jefferson fretted over the prospect of the return of a king in some form, either as an immensely powerful president unchecked by the Constitution of 1787, or in a more explicitly monarchical or dictatorial role. He did not oppose the wielding of power. He was a good-hearted, fair-minded student of how best to accumulate it and use it. In romantic moments, he dreamed of a future of virtuous yeomen living in harmony. In realistic ones, he suspected the America of which he was an architect could be yet another short-lived chapter in the story of the tyranny of the few over the many. We were educated in royalism. No wonder if some of us retain that idolatry still, Jefferson had once written to Madison. Eternal vigilance was critical. Courts love the people always, as wolves do the sheep, Jefferson once remarked. Even John Adams was susceptible to such worries. He wrote Jefferson in October 1787. If the Duke of Angoulême or Burgundy, or especially the Dauphin, should demand one of your beautiful and most amiable daughters in marriage, all America, from Georgia to New Hampshire, would find their vanity and pride so agreeably flattered by it that all their sage maxims would give way, and even our sober New England Republicans would keep a day of thanksgiving for it in their hearts. If General Washington had a daughter, I firmly believe, she would be demanded in marriage by one of the royal families of France or England, perhaps by both. Or if he had a son, he would be invited to come a-courting to Europe. Intermarriage with noble families in America and Europe, Adams believed, would lead to trouble, and to the United States repeating the mistakes and miming the bad habits of the old world. In short, my dear friend, you and I have been indefatigable laborers through our whole lives for a cause which be thrown away in the next generation upon the vanity and foppery of persons of whom we do not now know the names, perhaps. Talk of threats came from the American West. The politics of the Western country are verging fast to a crisis and must speedily eventuate in an appeal to the patronage of Spain or Britain, wrote a gentleman of Kentucky, James Wilkinson, in 1789, and the palaces of London. There is such a rooted aversion to us grown up in the court that if we could be smitten without the hazard of a general war or a risk of shaking the present ministry from their places, hostilities would be recommenced against the United States, if it were only to gratify the irascible feelings of the monarch, the American lawyer John Brown Cutting had written Jefferson from London in August 1788. In a report of a conversation with John Graves Simcoe, a British Army officer and lieutenant,